This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
You wake in the dark. Slowly, a light begins to creep across the sky. Indigo to blue to mauve to turquoise, layered one on the next on the next. Around you, more becomes visible. You're in a world. There is land, and there is water. There are trees. Perhaps there are animals wandering. They pay you little attention. And here you are, utterly free. You have a stick in your hand. You can hit things with the stick, or you can refrain. You can walk around, or you can remain still. There are no instructions. There are no goals. The world is pristine, and you are within it, and nothing has yet been decided. You may, if you like, dedicate yourself to the destruction of this little world. If you choose, you might build something, or discover, or dig, or climb, or find others, or remain alone. You can stand here forever, simply allowing the world to be. You are free. Your decisions and desires will shape your world, but you cannot escape your own freedom. No one else will tell you what to do. You are, in effect, condemned to be free. This is a video game. Its name is Minecraft. It is, perhaps, one of the most existentialist pieces of art ever created in a format, video games, that seems to have been born to express and explore the ideas of existentialism. Jean-Paul Sartre said of the human being, "Man first of all exists, encounters himself, surges up in the world, and defines himself afterwards. Man simply is. Man is nothing else but that which he makes of himself. That is the first principle of existentialism." There are, of course, existentialist plays and novels, essays and movies, but although those forms can discuss existentialism or describe it, although they can show us characters in the throes of the existentialist crisis or grappling with their lives in the terms of that philosophy, none of them can actually place the audience in the centre of that universal emptiness. The very nature of a novel, a play or a movie is that the character at its heart was created, does have meaning and purpose to their lives. Their point was to express the ideas of the author. There's only one medium which can create a central character of such perfect hollowness that we can begin to feel the ground slip beneath our feet. And in this essay, I'll suggest that the video game, the most popular medium of our young century, probably derives some of its power from the widespread, implicit acceptance of existentialist thought and ideas. So, back to Minecraft and to freedom. Minecraft is what we in video games call a sandbox or open world game. In both sandbox and open world games, the player is able to roam freely through a virtual world and can choose for themselves what goals to pursue or what to do. A sandbox game, so called for its encouragement of non-directed play, typically gives the player a great deal of freedom to change the world they're in. Players can choose to build or to destroy, sometimes to change the nature of the physics or geometry of the space they're in. Open world games are a little more limited, enforcing some restrictions, as, for example, gravity will always point towards the ground, but still creating huge open areas to roam through, either with no objectives or with objectives which can be achieved in many different ways. Minecraft is among the most open of all open worlds. In some versions, creatures will attack you if you don't build a shelter in the game world, creating an obvious, though limited, set of goals. But you can turn the attacks off. And then you're just there, with your stick, and a world, and no one giving you any suggestion of what to do. You might try hitting things with your stick. Hitting the earth, you could find useful minerals. Hitting a tree might turn it into wood. Hitting a pig could turn it into food. Bigger things can be built out of smaller things. Objects can be combined into further objects. You could make something here. And what things people make. projects built stone by stone in Minecraft include an imperial summer palace based on Schönbrunn Palace, Versailles and the Hermitage at St. Petersburg. There are vast Gothic cathedrals and multi-turreted castles. There's a 1 to 1500 scale recreation of the entire world. There are galleons and Babylonian cities and the space shuttle and, of course, a full reconstruction of the Middle-earth of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings series, as well as flights of fancy wholly original to the creators. These aren't pictures. They're fully realised virtual landscapes you can walk around in. They are extraordinary creations of human beings who, faced with emptiness, have chosen to fill it with effort and personal meaning. What can we make of this? What can we understand from it, especially when we combine it with the apparently evergreen media image of gaming as mindless, destructive and useless? Despite endless flowerings of creativity in games, newspapers do seem to love to talk about how games are pointless, how they promote lethargy and yet at the same time encourage violence and all that's worst in human nature. In fact, that consistent media portrayal of gaming reminds me rather of Sartre's railing against the media image of existentialism as a philosophy of despair. He wrote in 1944 that critics of existentialism said that its adherents were trying to corrupt youth and turn it aside from action, that existentialists liked to poke about in muck and were much readier to show men's wickedness and baseness than their higher feelings. Much as critics of video games think that the player's freedom to act in them leads to moral bankruptcy, Sartre's critics thought that the declaration that life has no intrinsic meaning must have been a cry of despair. But in fact, as Sartre says, it's precisely the opposite. Man cannot will unless he has first understood that he can count on nothing but himself, that he is alone, left alone on earth, in the middle of his infinite responsibilities, with neither help nor succour, with no other goal but the one he will set for himself, with no other destiny but the one he will forge on this earth. With despair, says Sartre, true optimism begins. In a sandbox game, we can do almost anything. We can build almost anything. We can be almost anyone. And far from causing despair, the understanding of our essential freedom sets off the bursting fireworks of optimism, which end with cathedrals, palaces, Minas Tirith and King's Landing. So, games model the freedom of the existentialist outlook. They're also the only medium which gives its audience choices. Central to existentialism, however, is that notion that our choices are what create us, that the decisions we make can radically change our lives. I write novels, and I write video games. Only one thing ever happens in a novel. But when writing, I often have the strong sense of a web of possible outcomes and behaviours for my characters, that the truth of them is in the web, not in a single story. I don't think it's a coincidence that the second half of the 20th century, the half after existentialism, contained a lot of interesting narrative experiments in the depiction of choice. B.S. Johnson's The Unfortunates can be shuffled and read in any order. John Fowles's The French Lieutenant's Woman has multiple endings. The 1998 film Sliding Doors depicts two different outcomes of a woman's life, depending on whether she does or doesn't make her train. But all these experiments in multiplizing a linear form feel forced or difficult, or at least not widely applicable. No, the best place to depict real choice is in the video game. There are far too many examples to list, but a few favourites of mine include the interactive fiction Slouching Towards Bedlam, in which the player ends up confronted with the choice between destroying the world or killing themselves. Or there's the classic psychological horror game of guilt and despair, Silent Hill 2, which has several possible endings, all grim, including one in which you, the player, are left with two choices: either kill the woman you love or stop playing the game. Condemned to be free indeed. Andrea Phillips, game designer and critic, has commented that while all art forms can elicit powerful emotions, only games can make their audience feel the emotions of agency. A novel can make you feel sad, But only a game can make you feel guilty for your actions. A play can make you feel joyful, but only a game can make you feel proud of yourself. A movie can make you feel angry with a traitor, but only a game can make you feel personally betrayed. The game is the only form that actually places the audience on that existentialist stage where we're all forced to find out who we really are. And this brings me to the third parallel between games and existentialism. A game, by its nature, is absurd. It is a thing we treat with utmost seriousness, which in fact has no meaning. 11 people kick a ball around a field, one side trying to get the ball in one direction, the other side trying to move it in the other. At the end of 90 minutes, whatever's happened, the ball will be carried off the pitch. It's not just football. All games are like this. In video games, we painfully learn how to scale the walls of imaginary buildings in places that never existed to claim treasure made out of pixels. Is there any clearer parallel in life for Camus' Myth of Sisyphus, in which Sisyphus is condemned to push a rock uphill for all eternity, knowing that each time it reaches the summit, it will roll back down to the base? Sisyphus is tortured, constantly, by the knowledge that the work he's doing is without purpose. And yet, as Camus says, we must imagine Sisyphus happy. As he tells us, the struggle itself is enough to fill men's hearts. Game designers focus hard on the learning curve of the game, making sure that the challenge remains in that perfect Goldilocks spot, not too easy, not too hard. Because players complain most of all if a game doesn't challenge them enough. We pick a game, we play a game, because we want the struggle. We choose that struggle for ourselves. Often, we define for ourselves what the conditions of victory will be. Perhaps we're happy playing a game on easy mode, using a walkthrough to see the story. Perhaps, like some players of hit game Half-Life 2, we challenge ourselves to play through the whole game while our character carries a giant gnome. This is a real thing. There are photographs online of people carrying this gnome through a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Actually, the giant gnome points up the existentialist nature of the whole enterprise. It's absurd. We know it's absurd. We do it anyway because we find a joy in the essential absurdity. And this, the existentialists tell us, is a way of thinking about life. Like the player of a video game, we arrive on the stage of life without particular purpose. The whole business of life is probably pointless. If we don't believe in God, in the perfection of mankind, in the world as a venue of a titanic struggle between good and evil, then there's no grand scheme we're forwarding with our work and effort. We've just chosen something and decided to put our effort into it. It might feel very important to us, but there's something joyful also in the absurdity of all our endeavours. If we can really sit with the knowledge that nothing that we do actually matters, then the business of life becomes lighter, not heavier. Like the player of a video game, the knowledge of this absurdity can make the whole experience of life more joyful. And like the player of a game, understanding the absurdity of our position really will set us free.